Welcome to the Science Podcast for November 23rd, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, planetary vibrations, 50 years of protein folding, and a brief history of chickens.
So there are a lot of aspects to chicken research that go way beyond simply breeding better chickens and embrace human history and anthropology and social mores.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. Just as doctors use X-rays to see within the human body, Earth scientists use tools that emit and detect signals to get a glimpse under the Earth's surface. This week, Piero Poli and colleagues present a new tool that improves upon conventional imaging techniques. Here's Carrie Klein with a story.
Much of what we know about the deep Earth, like the depth of the crust and the composition of the core, has been revealed through studies of seismic waves. The vibrations that scientists commonly track are those produced by earthquakes and by human activities involving controlled explosions and big vibrating trucks. But these methods have their limitations. For instance, earthquakes only happen so often in particular places, and we're not always able to determine the processes that touched off the quakes in the first place. These drawbacks make for inconsistent and sometimes imprecise subsurface imaging, which is why some researchers are investigating alternative ways to get at some open questions in the field, like the structure of the mantle.
Seismology is one of the best tools to provide information about the mantle. Here, we propose a new seismological way to imaging with high resolution the mantle structure.
That's Piero Poli, an earth scientist at the University of Grenoble. The new method he's suggesting for exploring features nearly 700 kilometers deep is based not on isolated events like earthquakes, but on ambient seismic noise, the field of background vibrations, quakes, and hums that we never feel, but that the Earth is undergoing all the time.
It's a technique that uses the continuous oscillation of the hard surface and is created, for example, by variation of atmospheric pressure, rain, wind, as well, and human activities.
We don't live on an inert piece of rock. It's continually oscillating and swelling in its interactions with the moon and the sun, and in response to changes in pressure in the atmosphere and the oceans. Even rain and wind can create tiny local disturbances. Scientists have already used seismic noise as a tool for discovering new features near the Earth's surface. For a long time, it was assumed that seismic noise could only penetrate the shallowest Earth, but a recent study suggested that wasn't true.
These forces generate seismic waves that travel into the Earth.
Deep into the Earth. As it turns out, seismic noise includes not just surface waves, but also body waves, which travel through the interior of the planet. And in addition to happening all the time throughout the globe, seismic noise has some other advantages over the signals produced by earthquakes.
Different from waves generated by earthquakes, seismic noise is completely random, and these waves propagate in all directions.
In other words, seismic noise is ubiquitous and far-reaching. And Poli decided to harness that widespread network of possible data. He did it by taking a lot of noise and finding the signal within it.
What we do is just correlate the noise recorded at two distant stations, and this correlation can provide information about the waves traveling between these two recording points.
Once that has been done for multiple station pairs, 861 of them in this study, Poli and his colleagues use the correlated data to construct a model of the Earth's internal structure that best fits the data. To demonstrate the power of this technique, the researchers used it to look more closely at an enigmatic segment of the subsurface called the mantle transition zone. The mantle is the dense, literally rock-solid part of the Earth's interior sandwiched between the crust and the core. It's nearly 3,000 kilometers thick. The transition zone, a slice of the mantle around 200 kilometers in thickness, separates the upper and lower mantle. And this is the part that attracts researchers.
The mantle transition zone is important because it plays a fundamental role in mantle dynamics.
In particular, it's a sort of bottleneck where the velocities of materials traveling through the mantle suddenly change. And not just the velocities of seismic waves, but also of molten mantle plumes rising to the surface and of subducted oceanic slabs sinking to the depths. From other earthquake-based seismic studies, scientists have determined that the transition zone lies at roughly 410 to 660 kilometers below the Earth's surface and is bounded by two discontinuities. But scientists have not been able to precisely determine the nature of those boundaries.
Here, by employing noise correlation, we can do that. We are able to reconstruct a model that showed the very fine structure of the mantle transition zone.
Using this jumble of vibrations, Poli and his colleagues were able to constrain the upper discontinuity in the area they studied to a probable thickness of 15 kilometers, and to narrow down the thickness of the lower discontinuity to just 4 kilometers. And remember, the lower discontinuity is located more than 600 kilometers below the Earth's surface. They did all of this with data from seismic stations in Finland, far away from any major earthquake sources.
We don't want to say that earthquakes-based imaging is useless, but we show a complementary way to study the deep earth that could improve the resolution of seismic deep earth pictures. Our results also show that noise propagates very deep into the earth, and this is a first observation. This observation will lead to new studies to understand the physics behind noise propagation and the reconstruction of seismic signal from noise correlation.
The mantle transition zone is far from completely understood. And as of yet, it's really only been imaged beneath a handful of locations. But with this new technique, Poli believes the potential is there for a much broader global insight into the deep Earth.
Hopefully, this method can be extended in a worldwide sense and could maybe permit a systematic mapping of the mantle transition zone. Further studies will explore the possibility to obtain seismic waves traveling deeper to begin the imaging of Earth's deep Earth structures,
including, he says, the core mantle boundary at a formidable 2,900 kilometers deep. For Science, this is Carrie Klein.
Piero Poli and colleagues report on imaging the deep Earth using ambient seismic noise in a report this week.
The chicken may be the most important domesticated animal around the world. A staple in food in many places, farmed chicken populations have grown to significantly outnumber humans. But what do we know about the origins of the chicken? Edward Hermey spoke with Science contributing correspondent Andrew Lawler about the surprisingly complex history of domesticated chickens.
Researchers actually know very little about how the chicken became domesticated. So where did it come from? How did it become such a common animal? In fact, it's the world's most common bird, and in some sense, it is the most important domesticated animal in the world since it provides the bulk of animal protein for humans all over the planet. So I was surprised to find out how little we actually know about how the chicken went from a wild creature to the very tame and necessary bird that we have today.
But what is the real importance of understanding the origin of chickens? Why do we want to know where the first one came from?
Well, yeah, of course, there's just the intellectual curiosity of, well, here's a bird that most of us have seen and certainly most of us have eaten. You know, what is the origin of this creature? Where did it come from originally? Now, there's also a very practical aspect to this. Because the chicken plays such a critical role in the world's food supply, understanding the genetic nature of the animal is really important. And part of that is gathering genetic diversity. So when you go back to the original chicken, that is the red jungle fowl, is found across South Asia, it's very valuable to gather the genetic data from birds like the red jungle fowl and other subspecies that are related to the chicken in case in the future people want to create different breeds of chicken. So actually gathering and protecting this diversity is potentially of enormous value.
So it's building diversity in defense of potentially diseases? Is that what you're talking about?
That's possible. Now, it's still early days, and as we know from the human genome, there have been a lot of promises made about how understanding the human genome is going to provide all kinds of answers to human illnesses, but we know today that it's actually going to take a lot longer to really be able to apply that basic research and use it for purposes that are very practical and day-to-day. So I don't think any researcher is saying that gathering this diversity is going to solve problems like avian flu, but no doubt it could be valuable in the future to put this in the bank, particularly given that a lot of that diversity is going away as a result of deforestation and crossbreeding in the developing world of these chicken-related creatures.
So yeah, you mentioned this just before, that researchers think the original chicken came from the red jungle fowl in Southeast Asia. So do they have a more precise idea of the epicenter of, you know, where chickens came from in the first place?
Well, this is a question that goes back to Darwin. And in fact, Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus, was interested in this too. The old thinking was, well, the red jungle fowl was in India, and probably it was in India where the bird was domesticated. And that was backed up by archaeological finds that were made in the 1920s and 30s of chicken bones that were found in the Indus River civilization, which is in today's India and Pakistan. So it seems that Darwin was right, that the red jungle fowl was domesticated. It was used in the Indian subcontinent, and then spread around the world. But in more recent years, there has been a lot more work done, both archaeology as well as in biology, molecular biology, that paints a more complicated picture. It seems now that the evidence is moving toward multiple centers of domestication. In other words, people cross South Asia in different places, maybe in southern China, maybe in Southeast Asia, as well as in India, and possibly even in Indonesia, some of the islands south of Southeast Asia, that the people in these areas were independently domesticating the chicken. That is a very hot topic now in the field, because to understand this is really critical for understanding how humans came into contact with the bird, how they were able to domesticate it, and maybe more importantly, how humans moved around and traded information and knowledge in these very early days. We're talking before the advent of writing. So it's very hard to piece together that history. But it looks like it's quite possible that the bird was domesticated in many different areas, which will make it challenging for researchers to go after that genetic diversity that they want to hold on to, since that means going not to just one epicenter, but going all over South Asia and trying to gather the birds that they can to get their genetic sequences.
Yeah, so this sounds like an incredibly difficult project. How have people begun researching the origin of chickens?
Well, there's a Chinese researcher that I just spent some time with in Vietnam who is gathering samples from all over South Asia. He's been traveling in Pakistan and Bangladesh, in southern China, in Vietnam, of course, trying to find red jungle fowls that can be used for sampling. And then in turn, he goes back to his laboratory in Beijing and wants to get the genetic data out of those samples. He's gathering a mass sample base, which is new. No one has ever really done this before. He's one of several people trying to find ways to get at the history of the chicken while at the same time providing what could be a genetic data bank, if you will, for the future.
So what are some of the challenges to understanding the origins of chickens compared to other domesticated animals like cows and sheep?
Well, a lot of attention has been paid to, say, goat and sheep. A lot of that is because we know a lot about what happened in the ancient Near East in the early days of agriculture and animal husbandry. This is an area that has been carefully examined by archaeologists, and as a result, we know quite a bit about what happened in that area compared to, say, South Asia, where there has been relatively little prehistoric archaeology done. That's the first point. The second point is that chicken bones are simply hard to find. A chicken bone is small, and chicken bones can be eaten by predators if they haven't already been eaten by humans. So to actually find the remains of chickens is remarkably difficult, and it's only in recent years with the use of, say, small seeds that they use at archaeological sites. If you're not looking for chicken bones, you certainly will not find them at archaeological sites. So it's only been in the last couple of decades that archaeologists have begun to pay attention to the chicken and begin to gather that data. But it's going to take quite a while to find the kind of information that we already have about cows and goats, sheep, which have been looked at so closely for a century or so.
So this research seems to have a lot of different parts to it, many different researchers working together from all different angles. Can you talk a little bit about how interdisciplinary this research has become?
One of the fascinating aspects of chicken research is that it's no longer simply some field biologists or agricultural specialists who are trying to breed a better chicken. Actually, the field has expanded to include molecular biologists who are doing very advanced genetic sequencing. You have anthropologists, like there's one named Naomi Sykes in England, who has been doing a lot of work on how chickens impact culture. There are archaeologists who are working in a variety of places, from Africa to China, who are very interested in looking at how the introduction of the chicken shows the movement of humans, that actually the chicken in a way is a kind of barometer of who's going where, and also the ways that chickens can change society. There's a great story that I will write and possibly in an upcoming issue about a researcher in Africa who has found that the introduction of chickens in the 8th or 9th century AD really revolutionized society by providing people with animal protein. They didn't need to depend just on the big cattle owners for their protein. So there are a lot of aspects to chicken research that go way beyond simply breeding better chickens and embrace human history and anthropology and social mores. Cockfighting is a fascinating subject that may have actually been the origin of the domestication of the chicken, not for its meat. So there are a lot of fascinating aspects that researchers from many fields are coming together to look at, which is definitely a new and exciting part of this field.
Wow. Well, Andrew Lawler, thanks for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Andrew Lawler is a contributing correspondent for Science. He writes about the mysterious origin of chickens in this week's issue.
Proteins do all the work of the cell. They transduce light in the eye, make up and actuate our muscles, serve as messengers, and structure our cells. And just like the variety of functions they serve, they come in an enormous diversity of forms. But how these shapes arise out of linear strands of amino acids is a long-standing puzzle. I spoke with Kenneth Dill about our progress and the important consequences of the protein folding problem.
In the 1960s and 70s, many people thought this was going to be an unsolved problem for a very long time, and that maybe we were even missing many of the basic forces of nature that we needed in order to be able to understand it. In the meantime, what's happened is on many different fronts, people have built physics-based models and other kinds of models to try to understand the interactions. And it's now the case that within computer simulations, we have models that are pretty good. Mm-hmm. So inside the computer, what you do is you build a model of the physics of how the amino acids interact with each other and just follow that protein molecule wiggling around as it would do in water by random thermal motions. Mm-hmm. And then the question is it able to find its native structure, and do we understand the physics well enough to be able to predict that structure? And I would say progress is quite remarkable. There are now a number of groups who are able to find the native structures of proteins, the folded structures of proteins in their computer simulations. And so huge progress relative to where we were 50 years ago.
So a second related problem comes up there, which is, can computers predict the structure of proteins from the amino acid sequence? Can we write algorithms or use different methods to get that information? Why is it so useful to be able to predict this with a computer rather than just observing how they fold?
The reason that we want to do this in the first place is because ever since the beginning of the folding problem, it's been clear that this could have a big impact on drug discovery. It would speed up the process of drug discovery. And the critical number here being that we now know, and this too has been an advance that's been happening over the last 50 years, we now know the structures of 80,000 proteins or so at atomic levels of detail. On the other hand, we have 1,000-fold more sequences than that. We have about 80 million sequences. And so what would be very powerful for drug discovery is if we, in the computer, could start with an amino acid sequence and figure out how to predict the three-dimensional structure, because that's really the working starting point for every drug discovery effort.
So moving on to a third problem that you raise in your review is the idea that proteins fold very fast and that this is surprising and it's really hard to figure out how they do it.
Right. So the protein folding problem has been regarded as a needle in a haystack problem. The needle being the structure that we're trying to figure out, and the haystack being it tries out all these different string shapes to try to figure out what's the right one, and it has to do this all pretty randomly. There were estimates back in the early days that it should take proteins zillions of years to fold up, and yet, in reality, real proteins and real biological systems fold up often in microseconds or milliseconds. They're very fast. What we came to understand over the last 50 years about how this works is, in terms of things that we call energy landscapes, They're like regular landscapes. And the way to think about this problem is I have a map of the United States, and I have a needle in Cleveland, and I'm going to roll a ball along this flat map in random ways, and the question is, how long does it take before that ball rolls through Cleveland and happens to find the needle? So that's called a landscape. What was discovered by the statistical mechanics community back in the 1980s was that the way proteins really solve this problem is that if you think about the map of the United States, it's more like a rubber sheet, and it's more like Cleveland gets pulled down to a deep hole. And so now it's really like when you're rolling a ball, the ball rolls straight to Cleveland. And that's how folding ends up being so fast. It's about energies, and it's about the fact that energies help point the protein in the right direction to fold up to its native structure.
So the native form is the low energy, one of the very low energy states for the molecule.
Exactly. And it's at the bottom of a funnel, basically.
So when you say it's a funnel, it means it can take a couple different paths there?
Yes, that's right. So if I start rolling a ball from San Francisco or I roll a ball from Chicago, this is very much like all the different shapes that the protein can start in.
So in this long-term project to understand protein folding, there have been a lot of side benefits, you point out, both to computing and to science in general. Can you talk about some of those results?
Yes, absolutely. One is computing. The protein folding problem was one of the principal motivations for IBM to ultimately develop its computer called the Blue Gene computer, which is now used in many, many different applications. And it motivated a method called distributed grid computing, which Vijay Pandey at Stanford has pioneered for protein folding. It's called folding at home. And what he does is he uses hundreds of thousands of people's screensavers so that many people all over the world are able to help him fold proteins. The development of distributed grid computing has been very heavily driven by protein folding. So that's on the computing side. Secondly, we have these force fields, these physics models of how the atoms interact, and they are very broadly used throughout biology, chemistry, physics, material science, polymer science. And so there's been a huge shot in the arm for the development of those methods over the years. And finally, I think one very big area was folding diseases. Back in the 1960s, when the protein folding problem first started, it was thought that all transmissible diseases came through viruses and bacteria, for example, from DNA. What was learned in the 1970s from people like Stan Prusiner, who won the Nobel Prize for this work, is that there is another way that diseases get transmitted, and that is if a protein folds incorrectly, called misfolding, then what can happen is that protein can contaminate other proteins, and then they all start misfolding. It's now known to be the basis for a large number of very important diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and type 2 diabetes and many others. But the big advantage of having a field of protein folding physical chemistry that had started a decade before that was that when these diseases became known and this folding problem became understood as a mechanism of disease, there were whole communities and tools and technologies from the protein folding business that were now available to study them.
We started with the three basic questions in protein folding, but there are actually a lot more puzzles out there. What are some of the more other outstanding questions in protein folding?
So one of them is membrane protein structures. I mentioned a minute ago that we know about 80,000 protein structures. Those are all ones that are called soluble proteins, that is, they dissolve in water. But a big fraction, a very important collection of proteins in all biological systems are ones that don't reside in water, but they reside in cell membranes. And it turns out something like half of all the blockbuster drugs developed by the pharmaceutical companies all attack membrane proteins. The problem is we have essentially no knowledge of membrane protein structure. Out of the 80,000, we have probably 50 that are membrane proteins.
Wow.
And so a huge unknown and a hugely important therapeutic area is membrane proteins. Second problem is we have no drugs that are working for folding diseases yet, for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and so forth. They probably will involve different kinds of drug discovery than has been successful for other kinds of diseases.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like 50 more years of interesting research to come.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, Kenneth Dill, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Kenneth Dill writes about 50 years of protein folding in a review in this week's Science. And that concludes the November 23rd, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.